Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip.
Somewhere south of Sunday, I'll be fine. Oh, you picture perfect queen. Pitching picture perfect scene. Having had enough of that. Drop the gas and strike the match.
Michael Perry and the Long Beds getting us underway today on Route 51 as we preview this weekend's Midwest Renewable Energy Fair in the rural hamlet of Custer, Wisconsin, just a few miles east of Stevens Point on Highway 10. I'm Glenn Moberg. Michael Perry is the keynote speaker at the fair on Sunday at 1 p.m. He is a New York Times best-selling author, a singer-songwriter, a humorist, a farmer, and the host of Tent Show Radio. And he will be our guest in just a few minutes on Route 51. But first, we turn to Nick Hyla, the executive director of the Midwest Renewable Energy Association, who can give us an overview of the other speakers, the more than 200 workshops, and more than 200 exhibits at this year's fair. We'd also like to hear from you. If you've got questions about the fair or a shout-out for renewable energy, give us a call right now at 1-800-780-9742. And if you'd like to talk to Michael Perry, give us a call in 10 minutes at that same number, 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a question on the Route 51 webpage, wpr.org/route51.
I sucked it up and I stomped it down and I blew right through your town.
Nick, you must be excited to have Michael Perry booked for Sunday afternoon. That in itself should help drive some ticket sales this year.
Well, that's for sure. We've been asking him to be a keynote speaker each year, and probably for the last 3 or 4 years, and finally it worked out in his schedule, so we're definitely excited.
Well, that's wonderful. Michael will be appearing this Sunday at 1 p.m. He has a new book out called Montaigne in Barn Boots, An Amateur Ambles Through Philosophy, and there will be a book signing at 2 o'clock. And, Nick, I was checking out the fair's website. You've got a full slate of things going on this year.
Yeah, so, each year we try to really focus on a theme. And last year our theme really was electrification. You know, the country is transitioning. Our electric sources of electricity are transitioning to clean energy. If you look right now, for example, in Wisconsin, 90% of all of the electrical generation that is planned to be built in Wisconsin is renewable or energy storage. It is right now the cheapest electricity on the grid, and so we really focused on that last year. We had the chief technology officer of Tesla speak, but this year, you know, a number of things have happened since last year, and this year, you know, our interest really was about kind of reconciliation and perspectives, and you know, as we say here in the Energy Fair, we're a big tent organization, and we put the tents up, and we invite everybody to come down. And I think Michael Perry really exemplifies that in his writing, is this idea of volunteerism and getting to know your neighbors and dropping the judgment and really really trying to become a productive part of the community. So we've really lined up speakers this year that we think will help us broaden our perspectives and maybe learn to talk to each other once again.
Well, let's talk about some of the other keynotes. Tomorrow, Friday afternoon at 1 p.m., we have Lily Raff McCullough. She's a journalist and an author from Bend, Oregon, and she wrote a memoir, Call of the Mild, Learning to Hunt My Own Dinner, which was named one of the best books of 2012 by the San Francisco Chronicle.
Yeah, she... You know, her perspective is from Manhattanite to hunter, and you know, this is a partnership with the Alda Leopold Foundation, and you know, I think the strength of her book and her discussion is really how she learned to appreciate conservation and hunting culture and practice in the United States, and how it really helped her better understand environmentalism and the conservation philosophy. And she really did this amazing transition, and we'll be talking about it.
Yeah, she worked in New York City's independent film industry, and she ended up moving to a small town to work for a small town newspaper, and she changed her attitudes in the process. Saturday at 1 o'clock. The keynote is Jeremy Scahill. He's an investigative journalist and an author who's dug deep into America's war on terror and uncovered some disturbing things.
Yeah, you know, we follow The Intercept here, a lot of us on staff. They do some really great reporting and have broke a number of news items that have been picked up by all the major news stations. And, you know, for him, you know, he has been he worked with Amy Goodman, who spoke at the fair a few times. And, you know, that he'll talk about the value of investigative journalism and independent journalism in this kind of age of fake news. And in particular, you know, the context of our continuing and never-ending, quote-unquote, war on terror, which if you've been following the news recently, you'll see that there's a bill working its way through Congress to basically make war permanent and give the president war powers permanently. And I think that, you know, he's a truth teller and a journalist, and we really think it's important to really focus on this concept of, you know, somebody needs to be out there telling the difficult stories.
And he's the author of an international bestseller, Blackwater and Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. And that book was made into a movie, which he wrote, produced, and narrated, and it was later nominated for an Academy Award for Best Feature. So this guy has a lot of talent in a lot of areas.
Yeah, it was, you know, that book is very relevant today if you realize that Eric Prince, who founded Blackwater, is pretty much a target in the Mueller investigation of President Trump. He's the brother of the Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, and is a central figure in the campaign coordination between Trump and Russia. And Jeremy Scahill had written that book a decade ago about the rise of Blackwater and basically the world's biggest private military.
His new book is called The Assassination Complex: Inside the Government's Secret Drone Warfare Program. And again, that's Jeremy Scahill, investigative journalist, who will be the keynote speaker Saturday at 1 p.m. at the Midwest Renewable Energy Fair. Nick, you've also got a showing of Solar Roots, The Pioneers of PV, hosted by filmmaker Jeff Spies. Am I pronouncing his last name right?
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's he'll be at the networking dinner tonight at 8, but then he'll be at the fair Friday morning, kicking things off at 9:30 in the morning. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that film?
Yeah, so I have yet to see the full thing. I've seen clips of it, and Jeff's traveled all over the country interviewing the pioneers that, 50 years ago really dedicated their research talents and their construction talents and their advocacy talents to solar energy. And so the documentary basically traces their careers and where they came from. And it's very, very interesting. He did a very good job, and I'm actually excited to see the full show.
And then also Saturday morning at 9:15, you've got Jonathan Reinbold, who's worked in sustainable agriculture and food systems, currently the research and grant manager for Organic Valley.
Yeah, Jonathan, we're really excited about this. You know, Glenn, I'm sure you know that Organic Valley has been a big supporter of the fair. They turn out a whole bunch of staff and volunteers and donate food and put on a $5 organic breakfast Saturday and Sunday mornings and completely donate all of the profits to the MREA. We couldn't be bigger fans of Organic Valley. They've grown from a small little vegetable co-op to pretty much the biggest organic food co-op in the world, and they did a really great thing this last year. We track and support a lot of solar energy deployment all over the Midwest and U.S. and businesses. And you can see this in corporate commitments to renewables. There'll be gigawatts and gigawatts of corporate purchasing of solar energy and renewable energy, and there already are. Some of the biggest leaders are Walmart, et cetera. And Organic Valley was really interested in powering all of their operations with 100% renewable energy, but they just didn't want to buy solar from anywhere. They wanted to buy it where their corporate headquarters were, and they wanted to buy it where their farms were. And so they did a really interesting thing, is they approached their local utility and said, listen, you know, we want to buy solar, and we want to sit down and talk with you and see how we can make it work for both of us. And they just closed a deal with a few cooperative utilities throughout their service area to install, I believe it's going to be 15 to 30 megawatts of solar, all locally, where their headquarters are established in partnership with the utility. So he'll talk about, you know, how corporations can really, with just a little effort, really stimulate a lot of local solar development. That, as you probably are aware, there are more people working in the solar industry in the United States right now than oil, gas, and coal combined.
And that's a statistic that doesn't get shared very often.
It isn't.
Jonathan Reinbold.
We need those jobs in Wisconsin.
Jonathan Reinbold, Saturday morning at 9:15. Nick, let's talk about this year's Clean Transportation Show. It's bigger than ever, and you're also giving people a chance Saturday from 10 in the morning until 2 in the afternoon to do an electric vehicle ride-in drive. You can actually take a test drive in an electric vehicle. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this is probably one of the most exciting things that's happened, I would say, during my tenure here at the MRE over the last 10 years, is just the incredible growth in electric transportation and the options that are out there, and some of the amazing news we've just heard in the last year of country commitments to completely electrifying transportation, major automakers saying that within 5 years they'll never make a combustion engine again, and we'll have pretty much every variety of electric vehicle here on display, probably more than 100 vehicles. We've just installed an advanced electric vehicle charging demonstration and solar canopy. So we have a DC fast charger. We have examples of workplace charging, and so we'll showcase electric vehicles from all the major manufacturers. And as you mentioned on Saturday, we'll have dealerships here and private individuals that throughout the day will allow anybody who's interested to take a ride or test drive some electric vehicles. And just for reference, that, you know, the Chevy Bolt, there's the Volt, and now there's the new Bolt, made in America. This car is all electric. It gets 240 miles on a charge, very similar to a gas engine, and a really amazing car, kind of the state-of-the-art of personal transportation right now, and you can come down and see it.
Made in America. You've got 200 exhibitors, 200 workshops, a couple of rock bands, the People Brothers Band playing on the main stage Friday at 9, and then GGOOLLDD Saturday at 9. You've got acoustic musicians all three afternoons, a lot of food and drink and camping on site. A lot going on. It's your 29th year. You draw more than 13,000 people each year. How about a shout-out right now to your staff and volunteers?
Oh, thank you so much, Glenn. I exist here in perpetual awe and gratitude for the hundreds of volunteers that come here and make this event happen. And the staff here are the best people in the world. So if you just come out to shake their hand and buy them a beer, it'd be worth it.
All right, Nick Hyla, thanks so much. We're going to let you go right now, we're going to be talking to keynote speaker Michael Perry in just a few minutes. That's Nick Hyla of the Midwest Renewable Energy Association. The Energy Fair gets underway tomorrow, Friday, and goes through Sunday. It's in Custer, Wisconsin, about 7 miles east of Stevens Point on Highway 10. If you'd like to talk to Michael Perry, give us a phone call at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a question or comment on the Route 51 webpage, wpr.org/Route 51, and I'll read it live on the air. I'm Glenn Moberg. We're going to take a short break. We'll be talking with Michael Perry when we return.
And them mail order hikers with kayaks on their cars, mostly Subarus. Tune to NPR. You got a lumpy little dog and a shotgun by the bed. He got a bucket load of chaos in his head.
We're back on Route 51, previewing the Midwest Renewable Energy Fair with Sunday's keynote speaker, Michael Perry. I'm Glenn Moberg. Here's one of Michael's songs with his group, The Long Beds.
So won't you choose me out of tombstone?
tell that man how to spell my name. Won't you choose me out of tombstone? Tell old Billy how to carve my name. No matter if the chisel slips, I'll be gone just the same. And that's the one part way my ma, two parts blame the man who got away. That's the one part blame my mama, two parts blame the man who got away.
Michael Perry, this song is called After Waymore's Blues. The last time you were on Route 51, you were here with Phil Anich, and you performed it live in our studio in Wausau.
Oh, man, I remember that. Is that the... Did someone drive through the wall of your studio?
Yes, they did. I'd almost forgotten that. That's right. We had a big car sitting in our hallway here, which was kind of appropriate, I guess, in a strange sort of way. Well, we're hooking up with you today from our Wisconsin Public Radio studio in Eau Claire. Are they treating you all right there?
Nicely done. Yeah, they left me all alone in this little studio. It's perfect. I like being alone.
Tell us a little bit about After Waymore's Blues. This was on your CD, Tiny Pilot.
Oh, that. So one of my great literary influences, and I'm not joking, I mean, I did not come to writing through an MFA or through the academy so much as Happy Chance and a few, an excellent seventh grade English teacher and a creative writing instructor I accidentally encountered during nursing school and college. But my literary influences, a lot of them were roughneck singer-songwriters like Steve Earle and Townes Van Zandt, and chief among them, Waylon Jennings. They were the first artists I ever encountered where I realized that you could try for art while wearing boots and jeans. And so Waylon Jennings was a huge influence on me as a writer. And then when I started writing songs, I suppose I was influenced. I'm always careful because I would never, ever claim to be anywhere in the same house as that man. But this song in particular is called After Waymore's Blues because I was still a bachelor and I was washing dishes one night, which means apparently I was out of dishes. I must have been down to chasing a Cheerio around the milk moat in the Bundt cake pan. And so I was washing dishes, which would turn into a five-hour extravaganza when you're a bachelor, and I had a little boombox on the fridge playing, and it played a Waylon Jennings song, Waymore's Blues. And so I went upstairs after listening to that and wrote this song with his song in mind.
Well, we can certainly hear Waylon's influence with your group and the music you've recorded with the Longbeds. Tell me a little bit about the band and what you do as a singer-songwriter.
Well, like most things, it started on accident. I was writing and just living in New Auburn, Wisconsin, in my house there alone. And I'd tried a few times to learn some guitar chords and failed each time. But eventually, a guy taught me a D chord. And then after D chord, I learned an A chord. And then one day I learned how to play a G, and then that was it. You know, now I knew enough to be dangerous. And I started writing songs as a way. I was, especially back before I had a family, I was a binge writer. I would write for 16, 18 hours straight all night long a lot of times. And you want to take a break, but you don't want to turn off that part of your brain that you finally got rolling. And so I would go over and pick up a guitar and work on a song. And I'd gotten about 20 or 25 songs written with no intention of doing anything with them. And then a buddy of mine who's been playing for years heard about them and said, well, man, you got to play those out. And I said, no, that terrifies me. And he went and booked us into a coffee shop in Hayward, Wisconsin. So I had to show up. And the story I've told 100 times, but it's absolutely true, is my first show in that coffee shop, I ain't saying I was nervous, but I cranked out a 60-minute set in 32 minutes flat. But what happened is that the folks there seemed to enjoy it, and they asked us back. And then I kind of, as happens, anyone who's ever done music will tell you, pretty soon there was a bass player, and then there was a keyboard player, and pretty soon you had a band. And then about a year into it, I'm on the road a lot. That's, you know, our family supports itself various ways, and part of it is me going out and speaking. And well, then I started doing band gigs, and about a year into it, my wife said, so you've got a band. And I said, well, apparently. She said, well, that's fine. That's great. She said, just so that within a year it's operating in the black. So she made me get really businesslike.
Oh, man.
Well, but it's great because she saved me a lot of time and trouble. So we play, depending on the year, we play between 10 or 15 gigs a year. Last year was down a little bit because I was doing a lot of book touring, but we're booking a bunch of dates this fall already. And I'm glad she did that because we have to be professional about it. But I also, I just love the band. We're friends. I love seeing them show up on stage. I have a core group.
And you're still performing with them around? You got any gigs this summer?
Yeah, we've got a couple. I can never rattle off my gigs because I'm on the road too much. If you just go to sneezingcow.com and then check the events page, there aren't a lot of Long Beds gigs on there right now because the booking agent is actually, I just had an email from him yesterday finalizing a bunch of them in the fall, November and early December. We're doing some.
Well, you've got a couple of CDs, a few CDs with the Long Beds, Headwinded, Tiny Pilot, and Bootlegged at the Big Top, and a couple of comedy CDs, the Clodhopper Monologues, and speaking about your website, Never Stand Behind a Sneezing Cow.
Truest line I've ever written.
How did that expression become the title of your website? And you seem passionate about that advice. Did that come from personal experience?
You better believe it. So I was just going to mention too, we're going in the studio next month to record a new Long Beds album, so that'll be out this fall. But the Never Stand Behind a Sneezing Cow, that I, you know, you make a few moves now and then that change your life and you don't realize it at the time. One of them, I wrote a book called Population 485, and I was just so lucky to do that book. But Never Stand Behind a Sneezing Cow comes in a close second because that came from, I would just wrote these little humorous pieces about a fictitious town called Foggy Crossing many years ago when I was just doing anything I could to try and get writing published. And I would write those for a little magazine called Wisconsin West, these little stories from Foggy Crossing. And somewhere in there, I did a thing of advice from farm people. And one of the things I said is never stand behind a sneezing cow. And it's funny, but if you grew up on a farm, you also know it's deadly serious, especially in the spring when they're just out on fresh grass. And I don't know how far we can go on the radio, but the bottom line is that, you know, if a cow sneezes and you're standing directly behind the cow, it's an issue involving ballistics and contents under pressure and things like that. And as I always say when I do it live, I say it is a jaw-dropping situation, although that would not be your best move. And what happened is I put together a little one-hour, one-man show and put it on at the Unitarian Church in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, because the Unitarians will let you ease on in there and do about anything. And so
yes, they will.
I recorded that, and I got it onto some cassettes, and I would take those cassettes around to gas stations within about a 40-mile radius, and I had a little cardboard box I'd put them out in, and, man, I sold those cassettes for years at the gas stations, and the title of the CD was Never Stand Behind a Sneezing Cow. And then the other thing that happened to me is I was living in rural New Auburn in 1995, and I saw this thing in a magazine that said www.something.com. And I just happened to live next to a guy who was a computer genius guy. And I said, man, what is this www thing? And he said, well, that's the internet. And you should have a website. You're a writer, right? And you do speaking engagements. And so he set me up with a website in around 95 or 96. And it's so funny because a couple of years ago, a magazine called me and they did an article on me as an artist who was an early adopter of internet technology. And I said, well, the only reason was because I lived next to this dude who knew what it was.
Or 96 is really, really early. You know,
I was cutting edge. Yeah.
Yeah. I was working at a television station at the time. And I don't think we got our website up until 97 or 98.
No, I was an accidental early adapter. And what happened then, of course, michaelperry.com was taken. And so I did sneezingcow.com. And what I figured is it's sometimes a problem because people don't know where to find me. But the good thing is once they hear it, no one ever forgets sneezingcow.com. Thing I'll say, I've gone on too long, but there is one thing I want to say. I was approached one time by an elderly farmer after a speaking event where I did the whole sneezing, never stand behind a sneezing cow routine. And he said, young man, I have a bone to pick with you. And I said, well, get in line. And he said, you talk about a sneezing cow. He said, a cow does not sneeze, a cow coughs. And I looked him in the eye and I said, sir, as a farm kid, I will tell you that you are exactly right. A cow does not sneeze, it coughs. But then I said, but as a humorist, I will tell you that a sneezing cow is a whole lot funnier than a coughing cow. I stand by that.
This is your first appearance at the Energy Fair, and again, you're going to be speaking Sunday at 1 o'clock. Do you have an organized message that you're going to share? What can people expect if they show up to hear you?
When I do an event like this, I'll do two things. Number one, I'll do some of my more tested and true humor bits and writing bits that I know will work with folks who have never heard me. And there are millions of people who have never heard of me. So I'll do some of that. But then I also, for something like this, I will mix in a few things that I hope have some relevance. For instance, this morning I was out moving chickens, as you and I discussed earlier off the air. And I was looking up at our granary, and we have a bunch of photovoltaic panels on top of our granary. And that's because of someone who, a friend of mine, who installs those systems. And that's been on the roof now for, I think, about 10 years. And so, I mean, I work in things like that that I hope are relevant and speak to that. I may or may not, depending on how brave I am. I may, in my last book, Montaigne in Barn Boots, I wrote about some of these issues, and I wrote about non-spill fuel containers and how sometimes in the interest of doing good, you can go right off the rails. I'll see if I do that bit. But, yeah, I always try to tailor what I'm doing to the group, and especially in this case, because this is just – I'm not a cause guy. I'm just trying to get through the weekday, trying to get the kids fed, trying to keep health insurance. We're a self-employed family.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a great appreciation for people who are out there working hard, trying to make the world a better place. The Energy Fair is just bustling with people like that. And so I will try to honor them in some way.
Do you think this is something we should be pushing as a society? Should our national, state, and local governments be finding more ways to encourage the use and development of alternative energy, or is this something that's kind of happening on its own anyway?
Well, you use the verb pushing, and I think that's always tricky. Of course, I think we should be doing more. I mean, the reason my wife and I decided to put those PV panels up, and by the way, I'm working really hard. I used to call them solar panels till my buddy Zeus, who's in the solar business, the renewable energy business, he'd always say they're not solar panels, Mike, they're photovoltaics. So I'm doing my best to use the right word. But I remember when we signed up for that and we put those panels, we live in an old house that really, if you really were going to be sticking to the bottom line, we should have first saved our money and built a really sound house. But we live in an old farmhouse. But what we really wanted to do was, yeah, we wanted to get a little electricity from the sun, and that has happened. But we also knew that by us putting our panels up, we'd have a little more data, and the folks who put them up would learn about them. And the local electric cooperative has been out to our farm many times to look at how we've done things and how it's working and what doesn't work. And so you hope in some way that you're contributing, even someone like me who's really probably coming into the tail end of things, but I'm just trying to pitch in a little bit that way. So the only issue I have is with pushing. I mean, I wrote in the Montaigne book about the curlicue light bulbs and how those things go over and how sometimes they can backfire on you. And so encouraging, I think. But you know what? This is my own issue. And I was raised a fundamentalist Christian. I'm a bumbling agnostic with traces of amateur existentialism at this point. I ain't looking for trouble. I'm just looking.
Uh-huh.
And whatever you believe is fine. I just am interested in, A, how you treat my family, B, how you treat my neighbors, and thirdly, how you treat me. But I think because of my background, I am a little bucky when I get preached at, and especially if someone hectors me. And so it's a tricky thing. I think that's why, for me, I'm just better off being down to fire meeting, and if the discussion of solar energy comes up, I don't have to say, you should do this. I can just say, oh, yeah, we got some of them. It's been pretty good. You know, we've learned some things. It's not perfect, but they're making a lot of progress. And it gives me an opportunity. For instance, every time I hear someone say how inefficient they are, I go, well, you know, actually, that might have been true 10 years ago, but here's a guy, and I can put them in contact with someone who can tell you that those things have changed. So anyway, I'm now starting to babble, which, you know, I get paid by the word. So. but I think I can do more by trying to be a quiet example. I don't know. I'm not a guy who's ever pretended to have the answers, and I am grateful to the people on the bleeding edge who do, you know, folks like Jeremy Scahill is going to be speaking this weekend. I mean, folks like that are doing the hard work and the tricky, dangerous work.
If you just joined us, we're talking to Michael Perry. He's a keynote speaker at the Midwest Renewable Energy Fair. This Sunday afternoon at 1 o'clock, the Energy Fair gets underway Friday at Custer, Wisconsin, east of Stevens Point. If you'd like to babble with Michael, you can give him a call at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a comment on our webpage, wpr.org/route51. I'll read it on the air. Waldo tweeted, and he asks, what was your favorite stop on the Don't Stop Believing tour? And also, he loved Population 485.
Unless I'm completely overlooking something, which is entirely possible. I'm a pretty absent-minded fella. I have an entire chapter in my Montaigne book about being absent-minded to a ridiculous extent. But I believe what Waldo is referring to when he's asking me about the Don't Stop Believing tour is the lead singer of Journey was a guy named Steve Perry.
Right. I met him in my previous life as a disc jockey.
Well, you're one up on me. I always used to say Steve and I are cousins, but he's not returning my phone calls. So I think I hope that's an oblique reference to Steve Perry, and if it is, I love that kind of trivia. But then he said he loved Population 485, and you know, I already mentioned that book. I owe such a debt to the place I'm from. A debt to the person who first suggested that I write that book, and to be able to be in that, to write at length and be allowed to reflect upon a place that means so much to me, but then also to try to write about it in such a way that I get emails from Mississippi or I get emails from New York City from folks saying that they understand a little more about rural life.
Well, Michael, I just realized now that Waldo punked me with that question. So thanks, Waldo. Good job. Let's talk about the new book, Montaigne in Barn Boots, An Amateur Ambles Through Philosophy. You have described the French Renaissance philosopher Michel de Montaigne, as I think you're supposed to pronounce it, as an unlikely alter ego. Explain how that happens.
Well, unlikely in the fact that, like you said, you're probably supposed to say it Montaigne or Montaigne, but I say it Montaigne. I have a whole section in the introduction about pronunciation and what that says about us and how we choose to say that name and how we should say it on public radio as opposed to how I say it down to fire hall. And I said, when it comes to me, I just, being a guy from rural Wisconsin and a cheesehead, for me it's Montaigne. Although I like Montaigne. I've heard some people say Montaigne because that reminds me of Tanya Tucker, and that's a context I can relate to. It's that whole idea of I love beautiful language. I love words. Poets and dancers and artists have transformed my life for me. I owe so many debts, so many places. But when I'm relaxed and comfortable, I like to talk like I always did growing up and dropping gerunds and stumbling around and not necessarily talking fancy. But then I also don't like to play dumb. I've learned a lot of big, beautiful words, and they mean things, and they mean specific things. And there's this whole anti-intellectual wave, and I don't want to be part of that. So when it comes to philosophy, writing about a French philosopher, that's my same attitude. I'm not the expert. And I go out of my way in the book to acknowledge the academy and the debt I owe to the academy and the debt I owe to intellectuals. But then I also turn around and go, but what good is it if it's in no way translating to the street level? And that's a big challenge. And so it's just me, honestly, me sitting in my deer stand reading Montaigne on my iPhone and going, yeah, I think the world needs to hear what I think about 16th century French philosophy.
Well, Montaigne was a French nobleman. He lived in the late 1500s. And he was speaking Latin at the age of two. He went to college when other kids were going to kindergarten, had an audience with the Pope. And you describe yourself as a barn-booted bumpkin who still marks a second-place finish in the sixth-grade spelling bee as an intellectual pinnacle. And you once had an audience by saying hello to Merle Haggard in a golf cart. So what do you see in this guy? What strikes you as something that you saw in him that is relevant to your own life?
Well, here's my very favorite thing in the whole wide world about him, and I hit it right away in the introduction. You could sum up his whole philosophy in the phrase, "I could be wrong." And you just don't hear that anymore. Everybody's really loudly and angrily certain that they're right. And so what I liked about Montaigne is he would take any subject and he would write about literature, he would write about art, he would write about philosophy, but then he would also turn around and write an entire essay based strictly on studying his thumb. He wrote a lot of interesting things about marriage and sex and very down-to-earth stuff. He wrote about what his favorite kind of drinking glass was. And so what I liked about him is he'll take anything and he'll go on and on about it, and he'll say, well, I think it might mean this or it might mean that, and then at the end he'll say, but I could be wrong. And so what you see is a person just trying to improve himself, trying to broaden his understanding of the world and the people around him. And so I would say that primarily that's why I enjoyed him. He's also funny. I enjoyed reading the things that made me laugh. But then ultimately he holds himself to account, and that's what I tried to do in the book. By the time the book winds up, I realized that I was having a little too much fun with the silly, naughty things he wrote and then missing the main message, which is, look in the mirror. How are you doing there, Sparky? Maybe you could do better.
I want to play a clip off of one of your CDs. You have waxed poetic on occasion about mundane subjects that are nonetheless important to rural life. Let's listen to one of your compositions, Ode to a Cow.
Girthy but firm at 1,800 pounds, the Holstein stood 60 inches at the withers, poised on clean hooves and draped nose to heels in a tight-napped pelt the color of drift snow and coal tar. At the vertex of flank and thigh, her udder bloomed a sculpted marvel, big as a bushel, firm as a block of butter, boldly veined, furred with clean white hair, the texture of toasted velour, and anchored by twin milk veins running the abdomen like woolly ropes. To press your cheek against this udder was to worship at the terminus of a genetic journey traceable to the Batavians and Frisians who first mingled their herds in the Rhine Delta around the time of Christ. This was a temple to butterfat, a shrine to calcium and cream, a ruminant Helen capable of launching 1,000 milk mustaches. This was a glorious clover-fueled bovine dream. This was Chippewa's Chipper Princess Turbuline. As I said, cows don't play a central role in my life anymore, but my brother still farms, and he heard me read that piece one time, and then afterward, he came up to me and said, "Stay out of my barn."
That's funny stuff, Michael. Life on the farm is something that grounds you and forms the basis of much of your work.
Yeah, and it also reminds me that I think in the introduction you said I was a farmer, and that's my own fault because I write about it and I mention my farm background a lot. But, man, I always, whenever I hear someone describe me as a farmer, I want to issue a blanket apology to farmers everywhere. I'm a writer with a couple of chickens at this point. That's what I am.
an intermittent pig farmer. How does that happen?
Well, how that happens is you write a book called Coop, which is a book about raising chickens, pigs, and babies. And then you go on a book tour, and when you get back home, your wife said, "I'm glad that you were able to go on book tour and talk about raising chickens, pigs, and babies, but while you were on book tour, I was here at home raising chickens, pigs, and babies." And her point is a good point, And so at some point, I had to realize that I couldn't raise the pigs anymore. And honestly, the most pigs I ever had at one time was five. So it's not like I had a huge barn of them. But I loved raising pigs, but after several years of it and getting up to five pigs, I just realized I couldn't be on the road as much as I am. And so I changed it to intermittent pig farmer because I do dream and hope that one day I will have a pig again.
Is it true that you can still milk a cow in the dark?
Oh, yeah, that's no problem. I grew up. That's like riding a bike. Once you've done it, you never forget how.
Our guest on Route 51 is Michael Perry, keynote speaker Sunday at this weekend's Midwest Renewable Energy Fair in Custer, east of Stevens Point. I'm Glenn Moberg. If you'd like to speak with Michael, give us a call at 1-800-780-9742 or put a question or comment on the Route 51 webpage, wpr.org/Route51. We'll be back with more after this short break.
Yeah, walk the line. Hear the sinner say his prayer. He says, God, are you out there? Wish I man, I wish I might bust right through into the light, wearing just my heart and my soul, all dressed up, no place to go. Home sweet home, here comes the sun. Bless this house I've come undone.
We're back on Route 51 with best-selling author, singer-songwriter, humorist, farmer, and the host of Tent Show Radio, Michael Perry, the keynote speaker Sunday afternoon at the Midwest Renewable Energy Fair in Custer, east of Stevens Point. Michael, tell us about this song, Undone.
Oh, man, wrote that a while back. I always liked the word undone. I think it suggests to me that some of the greatest source of humility for me has been being undone, knowing that I've messed up, maybe that I've messed up in a way that affected someone else. So it's just a song about that. And it also draws a lot on, I mentioned before, I was raised in a fundamentalist Christian setting. Very gentle, very loving. I still love the language of the Bible and hymns, even though, as I said, I'm an agnostic. And so there's a lot of that in this book, too.
Gospel.
And then just imagery. Like, I love imagery, you know, the idea of a flame being the same color as a comet flashing across the sky.
There you go. Gospel music is beautiful, you know, and it's the source of a lot of things in contemporary music. Ray Charles was influenced by gospel music. Aretha Franklin.
Yeah, we occasionally even sing I went to a very austere church. There was, when you sang hymns, it was a cappella, occasionally a very badly tuned upright piano, but mostly just a cappella and very austere, but we learned to sing harmonies, and occasionally at our shows we'll sing one of our old hymns just because I just love to sing them. I love how I feel about it. In the book, that Montaigne book you've been talking about, I have a whole section in there. I talk about the black Pentecostalist Ashen Crawley talking about how he left his church, a church that is very different than my church in many ways, but we both feel the same about the music of our church. We still go back and revisit it. We still love the poetry and the rhythm of the words and the feelings that they elicit.
On Tent Show Radio, last Saturday featured the Blue Canvas Orchestra and singers performing excerpts from the original Big Top Chautauqua production of Superior. I've always loved Lake Superior. It seems like a holy place to me. How do you feel about it?
One of my favorite things about going up to Bayfield, about going to Lake Superior, or even about, say, going out to Washington Island, I've done some performing out there, and Door County, or going to the Manitowoc area, things like that, just is that I, as a central, a northwestern Wisconsin farm kid, I need to be reminded on a regular basis that we are a maritime state. And I still, when I come over the last hill there and I see Lake Superior, if I'm going up to Bayfield, for instance, up to the tent, there's still this sweet little startle when I see that big lake and I go, oh, that's right. And yes, it's a thing of beauty. And the Apostle Islands, you know, there's just an example, and this kind of circles back to hanging out with people like the folks at the Renewable Energy Fair. You know, the idea that we preserve things like that has never been more critical.
Are you concerned about the future of the Great Lakes, the impact of people, the efforts to draw water out of them for a variety of reasons, the most recent of which is the Foxconn development? And now we've got microplastic beads turning up in the once pristine waters of Lake Superior. Do you worry about their future?
Well, I think concerned for sure. I mean, so I'll leave Lake Superior and I'll go way out of context, but I have relatives from Central America. My brother-in-law is from Panama. And then I also have relatives that live in the Virgin Islands. And we were down in the Virgin Islands a couple of winters ago visiting our relatives, and we went for a walk, a very isolated, tiny little island, very isolated beach, and not at all a fancy place, just been laying there open forever, and you see this beautiful beach, and then when you actually start to walk it, it's just stacked with plastic, and that stuff's coming from all over the world just to land on the beach of that little place. So it's like so many issues. Yes, I'm concerned, and we better address some of this stuff. And if we can ever get past the idea that just because you care about, say, too much plastic in the water, that means you're one kind of person left or right. It's like, no, we all ought to be able to agree on that. That seems like an issue. Maybe we should get to work on that. So,
how do the farmers, you know, feel about renewable energy and the threat of climate change? A lot of them voted for Donald Trump, who's a climate change skeptic and pulled out of the Paris Climate Accords. Do you think we'll see farmers in our lifetime eventually driving electric trucks, cars, and tractors?
I think if it becomes financially feasible. And I also think that I'm always leery when someone says, what do you think farmers think? I say, well, I think you should go talk to the farmers. I think about a lot of those issues, you got to get to know your neighbors, and it isn't easy. I had an exchange this winter with one of my neighbors that it was difficult, but it needed to be done, and it was quiet. And then we decided we got to live together, so you come to some sort of conclusion. This didn't happen to be an environmental thing, but I feel like sometimes when people say, well, what do you think we should do about this or that? And my answer sounds flip, but I'm serious. I'm like, well, you should go to the town board meeting, or you should go talk to your neighbor about these difficult things. So I think that, again, as far as what do farmers think, people vote how they do. This is one of the few times I was very public about the fact that I think Donald, that guy, is a big mistake. I was outspoken about it before the election. I put a thing on my website, which for me is very rare, even just from the perspective of my own family, where our family reunions are a mix of folks. Well, and so I was very straightforward about that. But I also know that I come from a county where 70% of the people didn't agree with me. And when I'm on book tour, they're answering fire calls. And if my little girl gets hurt, they're going to come and help her. So I can't just dismiss them. Can't call them idiots.
Michael, thanks so much. I wish we could go on for longer, but we're completely out of time. We'll see you at the Energy Fair on Sunday.
Thanks for having me. I'm very grateful.
The sun set at night. Living this way.
We want to thank today's guest, Michael Perry, whose new book is Montaigne in Barn Boots, An Amateur Ambles Through Philosophy. Also thanks to Nick Hyla, Executive Director of the Midwest Renewable Energy Association. You can find out more about the fair at theenergyfair.org. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Janice Schleiss. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music by Michael Perry and the Longbeds, George Harrison and the Beatles, The Fifth Dimension, and Willie Nelson and the Beach Boys. Thanks for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, and until next week, we're heading out of town.